Disasters, do they make communities stronger or tear them apart? Find surprising research on gross national happiness as a true indicator of the economy in a special presentation by the Tuesday Brown Bagger Program, CFRO Radio in Vancouver, Canada. This speech by Dr. John Helliwell, giving the forestry lecture in sustainability at the University of British Columbia, was recorded September 17, 2009. The introduction is by Jack Sadler, Dean of the UBC Faculty of Forestry. Following the speech, you'll hear comments from Dana Hayden, Deputy Minister of the Forests and Range, Don Roberts, Managing Director, CIBC World Markets, and Doug Konkin, Deputy Minister of the Environment.
I think the way we're going to start off is that we have John Helliwell, who will give the lecture today. I think, as you know, John is the Arthur J. Child Foundation Fellow of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, CIFAR, and he's the co-director of the program on social interactions, identity, and well-being. He's also professor of emeritus of economics here at UBC. He's a member of the National Statistics Council, a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. He was also a visiting advisor at the Bank of Canada, the research fellow of Merton College, Oxford at St. Catharines, Mackenzie King visiting professor of Canadian Studies. I think many of you will know John from his books, which include How Much Do National Borders Matter?, The Contribution of Human and Social Capital to Sustainable Economic and Growth and Well-being, Globalization and Well-being. And as I mentioned earlier on, I've actually got four pages here on John. So I think, again, it's someone else who requires no more introduction. So John, with that much abbreviated introduction, thank you very much for being our keynote speaker here today.
I'm doing a little research on the audience first before I start. Are you happy? If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. Okay. Have any of you seen this done before? No. Well, a couple. You remember, this is not the first time I have stopped at this stage, and I've said, you don't quite get it. To do the experiment fully, it isn't you listening to me singing and you clapping. It's you singing and you clapping. Or more importantly, it's us singing and us clapping. Should we try it again from the top? If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it and you really want to show it. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. All right. Now the science is... I didn't ask you before, but I'm asking you now, do you feel happier now than you did before you started? Well, that's important. And you're a lot happier now with me stopping you and starting you, us, doing it together than if I'd sat up and made a fool of myself doing it myself. And so one of the fundamental things we have learned in all kinds of circumstances is what really makes people happy is doing things together. And to an extent, we didn't know 5 years ago for other people. And I'll give you a bunch of experimental and other results to show that. And you can imagine how this is all going to play in to sustainability issues and forest community issues. But a lot of my examples, in fact, will come from far afield, different industries, different countries, and different times. The panel I gave in a Trojan horse way, a presentation on this exact topic I gave in Prince George 5 years ago. And then I said, today I'll say what we've learned in the last 5 years, because that was just before the CIFAR program got started, and now it's approaching its five-year review. So we've been doing a lot of work in this field over that period, and I ought to have learned something. Well, there's a checklist of things that were in that original outline. I'm not going to go back into those, but I'm going to tell you what we've learned since. Basically, I am now much more a psychologist and sociologist to go in with the economics than I was before, because this research team is several countries, several disciplines focused on these broader issues. So I, with a little more ease and a little more scientific support, I can pretend to be talking about the science of well-being as it is now coming to be known and coming to be understood. Well, the first slide I'll show you, which is one of the tricks of the trade is get somebody else to make your case for you. And this week, one of the big items in the news, as some of you will have seen, is the issue is the in Paris of the Sarkozy report, which was the French president 18 months ago had set up a pretty blue ribbon committee to look at whether GDP was an adequate way of measuring how well societies function. We have a couple of our own Trojan horses in that group, and so we managed to get stuff in and get stuff out. But this is what Joe Stiglitz, the chair of the committee, said on Monday. And it's exactly right. In order to extend the ambit beyond the numbers we know, it's necessary to collect evidence about things we know to be important, but we previously haven't measured. Because A, people measure what they think is important, but they need pushing to do it. And B, they pay attention to what's measured. So one of the reasons why the broader aspects of life, sitting GDP into the broader human context hasn't taken is because there hasn't been an analytic, an empirical, and a data-driven format to permit that integration. The social indicators movement of 20 years ago made a valiant effort to do it, but it never really got integrated with life. It didn't get integrated with governance. It didn't get integrated with policy. And it certainly didn't get into the boardrooms and the union shops. So we now have to start that process again. And so a lot of the last 5 years has been spent trying to kickstart that process. So this Sarkozy group is one of those. The OECD, which supported the Sarkozy group. Oh, by the way, whenever you come up with anything new that is offered to the world as a better way of doing things, people are going to come in and kneecap you because people are cynical. So what did I see in several editorials from the Wall Street Journal to this to that? Said, ha, Sarkozy was just doing that, or Sarko, whatever they call him, was just doing this because France wasn't doing so well in the GDP stakes, so they thought for look for some other metric that he did do well on. Now, it is true, I've now learned enough psychology to know that is a natural part of the human condition, that you focus your memories on what your positives rather than on your negatives. But they weren't giving Sarkozy enough credit, because he give him credit for realizing that France's problems are not just about GDP not being at peak levels, but GDP isn't what's most important, and France is not perfect in those other things. So that France, in fact, ranks lower in the well-being rankings than they rank in the GDP rankings. So he knew that, but still he wanted to change the system to get a broader measure of well-being. So give him credit. Don't take the cynical line. Well, what Joe was saying there is that there are recent methodological advances. Well, I'm one of those players, and I'm going to tell you what some of these results are. So his bottom line, they demonstrate the importance of social connectedness. Indeed, they do. But before you can do this in a really big basis, you have to get the data, right? Well, we don't have enough data on the kinds of communities that interest you day to day, so I'm going to be drawing my examples and a lot of the experiments from other places. But I can almost guarantee to you that the lessons that I'm going to speak about are transferable. But I do know that lessons never come in top-down. They never come in lobbed from 300 meters away. They come from individual people wanting to do things differently and in a different way. That's absolutely critical, and I'll give you some examples on that. Now, first, my only pictures are some data. So the first one I'm going to show you is that among the things that we've managed to do over the last 5 years is start the collection on a more systematic and regular basis of the quality of people's lives. So the Gallup World Poll has now had 3 years of going out and asking 100,000 people in 140 countries to look at the quality of their life today. They're in roughly deciles, and the green are the highest ranking ones, and the red are the bottom, and you can see how that works. Well, I told you before that France was not top of the well-being rankings. One member of the Sarkozy Commission, Dan Kahneman, did any of you hear him when he came to talk here 3 years ago? He's an absolutely first-rate psychologist who won a Nobel Prize in economics for the work he did and how people make decisions. He's been a leader in this field. I had a running argument with him about whether these international differences in well-being meant anything. And he had a joke he told at the seminar here, and he'd tell frequently. And he said, these guys tell you that the average unemployed divorced Dane is happier than the average French person. And he would get, it's funny, right? Well, he got a better laugh out of it. He must have told it better than I did. Damn. Anyway, it worked for him. And the point is, that was exactly what the equations say, that in fact divorce is very bad for well-being, and unemployment is very bad for well-being by much more, than, as Joe Stiglitz said, very much more than the financial cost of it. But the average Dane is a whole lot happier than the average French person. So what was Danny Kahneman trying to do? He was trying to say this is all about mood. Those international differences don't mean anything. They don't tell you anything. Everybody looks at the... Well, anthropologists have played this game for a long time. Every culture is so specific unto itself, you cannot compare them. You cannot say how people in Prince George react to things and compare it to how people in Cranbrook respond to things. Well, one of the things we've done with these global data, now we've got them, is to ask that question. We didn't have these data very long before I got an email from Danny, and he said, okay, you're right. Why did he say that? Because these differences are so large and so systematically related to things we can measure about the circumstances of people's lives that it becomes foolish to say that these differences are just a matter of mood. So in some sense, that has now been settled. Well, let me show you, if you're numbers people, we can now explain 85% of the difference across countries in these average scores by five or six measures of life circumstances. Assuming all people react to those life circumstances in the same way, we know that's false, right? We know everybody's got their own culturally specific way of doing it. When we account for the cultural specificities, it only adds a little bit to the explanation. In other words, these differences in the way people view their circumstances play a tiny role compared to the difference in life circumstances in their overall life satisfaction. So these data really mean something. They mean something across countries, and they mean something across communities. So this is income per capita. It looks a little similar, but it ain't the same. It turns out, of course, as I'm going to show you in a moment, here is, do you have a friend or relative to count on? Very important. The Gallup poll is weak in what it asks in the social context. So I'll be able to tell you more from our Canadian and U.S. polls that focus in on the social context more directly. We haven't convinced Gallup that the social context is really important, so they don't yet ask enough questions. So we'll do even better at explaining the data when we get the right variables. But this is one that is very apposite. This kind of disconnection, of course, it's very high. You see, you may not see, but I can tell you that everything from a light green to above means 85% of the people think they have somebody to count on. Of course, we'd really like to know how many people they have to count on and how much they can count on them. But you can see those that don't. And a lot of the unfavored countries in income and life satisfaction are, in fact, unfavored. So one of the reasons why you don't have poor but happy people in Africa is that in Africa, all the non-economic things are going badly, too. So yes, there are some poor but happy countries, and they're the ones where the economy is not rich, but a whole lot of other aspects of life are going well. And I'll get on to examples. Donating money to a charity. Well, remember I told you at the beginning that one of the things we've learned in the last 5 years is that people actually get happiness from doing things for others. It's totally against the basic economic assumptions that people are individualistic and after looking after themselves and their families in a material way. Well, A, the material is not as important as that would seem to imply, but other people play a much higher role, collaboration with them and doing things for them. So here are people who didn't consume stuff themselves but gave it away to other people, and even when we take out the effects of income,
it turns out to be a very important determinant of happiness. Liz Dunn in our psychology department here has a lovely set of experiments where she has two groups of students, and one group gets money and asked to spend it on themselves, and the other group's got money and asked to give it away. At the end of the day, the ones that gave it away are happier than the ones that didn't. But the interesting thing, there's good news and bad news about that. The good news is people really are happy doing things for other people. The bad news is they don't know it. I mean, that's serious, right? Because if they knew it, they'd do it more. But they don't know it, so they don't do it. So they're denying that by denying other people the benefits of their generosity, they're denying themselves the well-being they get from doing it. Now, Charles Montgomery, a journalist who's doing books on this thing and has written some nice pieces on it, went through these studies, and he was in San Francisco airport, and he said, okay, I know about this. So he said, I'm going to try it. So he saw a woman struggling through the airport with a lot of luggage and two small children, and he went up to her and said, may I help you, ma'am? Took her all the way through the airport with her bags, and she was overjoyed, of course, for this assistant and the friendship and everything else, and he was pretty cock-a-hoop about it, too. And at the end, he blew it. He said, I have to admit to you that I only did this because... you get it, right? Because I was told it would make me happy. And so he came back and said, what about this basic philosophical problem? I said, you're framing it wrong. Everything about happiness is framing, right? The way you frame it is you say, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this, and it was pretty obviously the case, that this helped the woman and her children and made them feel better. That's a sufficient reason for doing it. Why should I let my shyness about the fact I got a bonus by way of feeling better for doing it, make me not do it at all? That'd be stupid, right? It'd be leaving the woman less happy and leaving you less happy. If your happiness comes from doing somebody else in the eye, if it's a beamer that you're talking about that's giving you happiness, then think again. Because as opposed to this reaching out, which has what we call positive externalities, they feel better for it, and you feel better for it, everybody wins. Win-win. Consumption of material things, particularly what are called status goods, are the other way around. So that when your income is higher and you have more consumption, you feel better, but other people feel worse. So the net effect is very much less. And I'm going to get on to the specific example of that in a minute. Now, freedom is very important, it turns out. It was an Italian scholar who discovered this. I'd done work on this for 5 or 10 years before I realized that this was true. He'd done data mining, as it's sometimes called, and he discovered this very tight correlation between are you free to make life choices? And it turns out it was extraordinarily important in most of the data samples we now have, but doesn't affect any of the other effects. So it's absolutely independent the way it comes through. But the interesting thing is, are these the countries that rank highest in Fraser Institute Economic Freedom Indicator? No, they're not. These are people, are you free to do? So who's top on this? The Danes. Canada's above the U.S. It sort of reverses a lot of the lines about everybody free to rags to riches and so on. This is actually asking people where they live about their life choices. And of course, a society in which people care for each other and look out for each other is where you have the freedom to make your life choices, because you have a broader range of choices and more support in them. Is religion important? Here we find a reversal of the previous orderings, where Africa comes up as the hotspot for religion. Religion turns out to be a support for people's private well-being, but if you look across countries, there's a negative correlation. We're still working on that, and we... there's a negative correlation between whether people think other people can be trusted and their strength of their belief in God. So we don't know, is it across individuals, is it across countries? We don't know whether people who are everybody needs to believe in something. If you lose your faith in other people, then you sort of, I mean, it is true, who do people ask for help in the last moments of their life, that sort of thing. So there may be, we don't understand it yet, why should I talk about that when there are other things I do know about? you may wonder whether that's true, but I'll give you a chance to decide for yourself. One way of using these data is to then say, well, if we can model these relationships, and we can look at country A and country B and say, I wonder how you explain the fact that country A is happier than country B. So we can take any pair of countries, and this one I've used Pakistan and Canada. Why did I use Pakistan and Canada? Well, the OECD held a conference in Florence in July of national statistical offices in order to try and convince them to push ahead in measuring subjective well-being on a systematic basis. And they are doing that now. They're actually putting out manuals for how to collect these data and get them as part of the national framework of accounts. Well, bless his heart, the new chief statistician of Canada came and was an important support in this meeting, and his name is Munir Sheikh, and he was really interested in this stuff, and he's pushing it along and integrating it across surveys. But he said, one of the things that bothers me is that if you ask me how happy I am, I'm a 9 out of 10. He said, but you ask my brother in Pakistan, he'll say he's a 9 out of 10. And he said, I know life there's hell. That's a puzzle. So then I went back and we looked at the data. Chris Barrington Lee did a lot of the work. And we said, all right, let's answer his question. What are the average life satisfaction scores in Pakistan and in Canada? And what does explain the differences in those lives? It turns out there are a lot of people in Pakistan who are 9, and his brother may indeed be one of them. But you can see the average is way less. See, these are points on 10 out of 10 on the bottom. So the average Pakistani is 2.5 points lower on a 10-point scale than the average Canadian. Well, that's a big number, right? It's about a third of the higher number. So we can say with some confidence the average Pakistani is. It doesn't rule out the fact that he may be spending too much time commuting and his brother may not. I mean, there are lots of reasons why his brother could be happier as he is within a context where the average person isn't. Well, this is the average person. GDP per capita is a big component of the difference between the two. Canada's extra. But a lot of other things are. Friends to count on, freedom to choose, perception of corruption, helping strangers. You know, those are the big ones. So these social factors really play in. You can take any pair of countries. Now let me turn to provinces. So I'll get to communities eventually, but this is close, this is closer, this is at home, this is Canada, this is where we live. And when I show this picture, people say, what's going on there? Right? Do you intuit what that picture is? It has life satisfaction scores on the vertical axis, and then it has mean income on the horizontal axis. And the little vertical lines are the standard error bars, so you know if they're non-intersecting bars between two provinces, they're significantly different in terms of their average happiness. So where are they happiest in Canada? This is a quiz, right? I mean, have you turned off your BlackBerry and are you watching this? Atlantic Canada, right? And where are they least happy? Why in this room? Now you know why. I am single-handedly bringing down the BC score. So you want to know, well, what's going on here? You've already told us that income is an important support for well-being, and yet this doesn't work out across the Canadian provinces. You like that better? So this is the average extent to which people think their neighbors can be trusted. Now, this particular question, in fact, I think I'm right in this, is this ESC or is this all the surveys? Okay, so it's a mixture of how likely you think your neighbor would be to return your wallet if you dropped it, and other surveys where they just ask how much you can trust your neighbors on a scale of 1 to 10. Well, you can see it's a pretty straight, solid line there, right? So now we can play the same game with these data that I just did with Pakistan and Canada and say, well, why is BC on average, BC residents, not as happy as the average resident of Atlantic Canada? There you go. Trust in neighbors is the biggest one. Time spent socializing with friends, time spent socializing with family, you can understand why those actual numbers are higher in Atlantic Canada than they are here. The modeling tells us how important those aspects of life are. So we put those two things together. How important are they with the differences? We can explain them. The fact that something turns out not to be important is explaining the difference could be just because it's the same in both provinces, right? If we socialized equally in Atlantic Canada and here, then it wouldn't explain the difference between the two, even if it was extraordinarily important. So this is not about importance. This is decomposing the difference. So there you go. And here's income. You see, BC, average incomes are higher. You see that little bar that goes out to the right, log of household income? So yes, it counts. Yes, it's significant. But it's not big enough to offset those other factors. Just not big enough. So this is my way of asking you to rethink your lives, right? Because you're used to thinking of success and failure and something working out well and something not in terms of its material consequences. You're taught that from the ads to the whole range of ways. It is the sort of standard. I'm saying, wait a minute, these are real people we're talking about here. We're asking them how happy they are with their lives, and we're getting other details about their lives, and this is the story we're coming back with. Here is something Chris put together for health regions. We're working on bigger samples of data now. And thanks to Munir Sheikh and others, we're now starting to accumulate these data regularly, so we ought to be able to get to Cranbrook and Creston with some reliable data before too many months or years have gone by. You see here, once again, the places that are held to be ranked in these magazines about great places to live, like Vancouver gets this ranking. Are people happiest in Vancouver? Well, no, they're not. Are the reasons why they're not as happy the same as the difference between Atlantic Canada and BC? Yes, they are. Oh, this is my last picture. I'll save it. Because now I've got to get to what you really came to hear me talk about. I've been sort of motivating it, trying to get you to take me seriously. And now you want to know, how does this play out in forest communities? Well, one of the things, actually, that the Sarkozy report said, I didn't put it up in a slide, is that one of the things the GDP completely fails to do is capture the sustainability of human action. Misses out, right? You may be just living high off the hog, but the hog is disappearing. What they also fail to do, of course, as I've given you several examples now, is to unravel the nature of the social structure in which people work. Now I'm going to give you a couple of examples about how the social structure affects how a community reacts to adversity, which is a sense in which people rethinking forest communities in this province are doing that. They're saying things haven't, whether it's the pine beetle or the markets or the forest base or the conflicting demands or a whole range of things, people are saying, you know, business as was is not business as will be, and we're not sure we want it to be, but it can't be, so what next? And so people are rethinking, and so one way of thinking about this whole set of things is a little bit like a natural experiment. My other stuff was about correlations, right? People are much more convinced about the science if you can do the experiment. So Liz's experiments with the students are real experiments, lab, but other kind of experiments are natural experiments. Well, one of the first ones I thought about, and I even saw it before that 2004 presentation, was earthquakes in Italy. It turns out in the high social capital parts of Italy, think Friuli, they had terribly bad earthquakes 20 years ago there. Compare it to Irpinia or Sicily, where they had earthquakes of roughly similar size at roughly similar times, and ask what happened in the consequence of that. Now, we know from other data, Friuli is very high social capital area. Not true in Irpinia, not true in Sicily. Immediately after the earthquake, everybody immediately set about repairing each other's houses. They didn't ask who's going to pay for it, where's the money coming from. They just started and did it. In the low social capital areas, people sat on their hands and waited for the central government to send money. And when the government finally sent money, they fought over the money. And the building never did get redone, except in one of the examples where it got done to build buildings for somebody who wanted to own the buildings and sell the buildings. So, I mean, that wasn't exactly what the original intent was. Well, it took me a while, but I finally got some Italian colleagues, and I said, let's treat this really seriously. And so we had some meetings at the International Society for Studies of the Quality of Life, were holding meetings in Florence at the same time as this OECD conference, so they took me over to talk to the first, and so I said, why don't I give a paper at the second and see what's going on? So I had a chance to meet with the Italian colleagues at that time. We were talking about this, and the more I started talking about it, the more I said, what good are we going to do from this research? Because the more we talked about it with Italian scholars, everybody knew it. So we'd be making the people in Friuli feel good. But they already felt good. You know, they know that they were happier in these communities after the earthquakes than before. How could that be, you said, when family and friends were lost and damaged? Because it gave them a chance to show what they could do and do it and build it. And so facing an adversity, in fact, in a cooperative mode, can make you a whole lot happier than you were before the diversity. And that often leads people then to query some of these well-being data, because they say, how could somebody who's had an accident be happier after than before? I say, ask Mike Harcourt. He'll tell you how this works. It works because you, in fact, reorient your life, you reach out in other dimensions, and you learn to deal with the adversity, and you discover a whole lot of new dimensions. So it's not implausible, it's not impossible. But in the communities with low social capital, they know it didn't work. They know they're unhappy, they know their rebuilding didn't go. Why should we, as well-being scholars, rub it in their faces? So then the question, we then said, what should we be studying? So at this same meeting, fortunately, there was a fellow named Kasuga, Taka Kasuga, whom I'd never met before, but I'd given my talk on these international well-being. He came up after, he said, I really want to talk to you. He said, this is just like the kind of stuff we're doing. And I said, tell me more. He said, I want you to come and hear my paper. So I went and heard his paper. He was talking about the Minamata disease. Is that a familiar thing to you? Well, in 1956, I think, they first started discovering people in the western shore of Kyushu, the southern island of Japan, were dying in abnormal numbers. And it turns out it was a mercury poisoning that had come from a chemical process in the big local employer that had been going into those waters for years and gradually building up the stock in the fish-eating humans. Instead, they were suffering all the classic mercury poisoning symptoms and dying. Well, this community was destroyed. Of course, the factory was destroyed. And at that time, he and others came along. You see, this was poison for a long time, and it started unraveling in the 60s and 70s, and they sort of tried to make restitution and recovery and truth and reconciliation and all these things, but nobody was making anything out of the remains of this community. And they said, this is not right. So they developed what they call the Minamata model. And he now goes around, and he's in Brazil at the moment, dealing with the Brazilian authorities, trying out these same kinds. Maybe we'll get him here sometime. But the notion is that you have to have the chance to mobilize people to work together for each other. Just what I'm talking about. And it works. And so they said, what are we going to do? We're coming out of environmental disaster. Why don't we become the champions of environmental good? So they set themselves up to write bootstrap stuff, right? They started recycling before other people recycled. They were doing all kinds of things and sort of building green industry and so on. So they started winning all these awards. They then started doing everything locally. They said, you know, what have we got here? They rediscovered their history. They started doing a whole range of things. You can follow it up through the internet if you want. But it really made a difference. So Minamata, from the most, you imagine how destructive it is, where you've got the people who are relying on the company for their jobs and the people who are dying from the mercury, the tensions and the pressures and the pain, to reconstruct a happy community from that starting point is pretty impressive. Another paper at the conference. A fellow who'd studied happiness before and after the tsunami, comparing Aceh and Sri Lanka. And it was as different as chalk and cheese. So they got the people after, this is now 18 months after the tsunami in Aceh, were happier than they were before. Now, on average, they'd lost friends and relatives and lots of physical damage. Why were they happier? Well, they'd received what has now been called the peace dividend. This was such a big disaster that the religious cultural wars they were having in that part of Indonesia with each other and with other Indonesians paled into significance. And everybody said, this is a human disaster that requires us all to work together. So the working together in the common cause had a well-being effect sufficiently great to cover and be bigger than the losses they had of a material and human sort from that damage. Well, that's an extraordinary story. Well, these people were all reporting themselves happier now than they were before the tsunami. All right. You say, oh, well, that's just, there's something wrong with those data again. So I said, well, they did the same thing, bless their hearts, in Sri Lanka. And they did precisely the same exercise. Were they feeling happier after the tsunami in Sri Lanka than before? Not in your life. They got a war dividend out of it. So you could imagine what's happening between the Tamils and the others. You see, they didn't trust each other enough to give aid and in money form because it'll be turned into arms, etc., etc. So you can find the disaster driving a fragile community apart. They'll be looking for someone to blame. They'll be looking for a scapegoat. They'll be finding enemies everywhere. It was somebody else's fault, and we're going to get them. Any of this sound familiar? Forest community? The point of the Minamata exercise is that it has provided a way to come in and make things better. It's not enough. And you see, they're saying, in Italy, North and South have had different levels of social capital for centuries. So you just say, well, things are always going to work out in Friuli and they're not going to work out in Irpinia. That's madness. If the human state is going to be made better, we have to make it better village by village, country by country, community by community. So there has to be potential for change. So these experiments of the Minamata model sort are precisely what do it. So I got on the phone a lot and said, can we get any points of light around the province that I can use in this lecture? Bill Adams put me on to Phil Dobson, who started the mill in Chimenez 25 years ago. Well, those of you who know the industry well will regard that as a special case. But, of course, part of my question to Phil was, why is it a special case? Because it was the Minamata model applied in Chimenez, right? You don't know the history of that, right? The mill, it was in bad time, shut down. The question is, what are you going to do? Well, they said, we want to save this community. We want to make it work. We are going to start an entirely different sort of mill. Now, they started a mill of the sort they would have started had they read this research, which hadn't been done. So they already knew the obvious human truth or they were discovering it, actually. They were surprised to the extent this was true. Well, they put out ads for 200 people to work in this mill, and they said, this is not going to be a mill with defined jobs. This is going to be teams. We're all in this together. We're going to be working together in a common cause. There's not going to be any us, them, or on. There's going to be one lunchroom, and everybody works in the lunchroom. How did they do it? Because the community was in a failure enough, and the company was in a failure enough, that the company was, local management was prepared to give them freedom to maneuver, and the union was prepared to give them freedom to maneuver, and they had it and they used it. They had 200 jobs put up, and they had 3,000 applications. They said they won every prize around. They had the cleanest mill. They are pushing on the environmental agenda, everything. Why? Were they being forced to do it? Were they being pushed to do it? No. These were people that had learned the benefits of cooperation. These were people who took pride in each other's activities. I said, what are the secrets about making it work, Bill? He said, you know, the key thing is you can't hold information like it was scarce resources. You have to put all the facts on the table and say, if we're in this together, I'm not just going to feed you a dog biscuit to make you jump up and go through a hoop. I'm going to give you the same information base I have, and together we're going to solve the problem. So when you sit down at the lunch table, he said it was critically important. Profit figures coming out of that mill from the cuts were available every day and every week. Well, of course, the Sawyers knew how to deal with that. He said, I can think of a way. Given this circumstance, I can think of better ways of doing this. So everybody, the closer you are to the pit face or the saw head, the better position you're in to be able to think of ways of rejigging things. There are big issues and small issues. And apparently they are still the happiest mill in the province. And I said, the obvious question, right, aside from why I've talked so long, how's our time going? I'm just about it. I'm going to stop in two minutes. Oh, I won't stop. I'm going to be Chairman Mao, and I'm going to carry on for 2 hours. That's not so funny, is it? The obvious question is, if this was such a wonderful thing to do, if that was the way to run a town and a mill and an industry, why didn't it spread? Now, everybody knew this mill was magic. And nobody's given me a really good answer, except that everybody was stuck in their old line ways, from the business school side to the union side to the corporate side to the municipal side, of playing by the rules and doing the best you can for your part of the team in those existing rules. And none of them were thinking together in a cooperative way. Well, it was pretty obvious from all the stories I got that they sure were a lot happier working in that environment. They weren't just happier. So it isn't as though you buy happy by giving up material things, you get more happy. That's not the question. When you set up the right kind of social environment, it turns out you're more productive as well as happier. So it isn't as though it's an either-or situation. You do everything better. And you have broader interests, you have broader focus, and everything turns out better. I looked for other lines. You know, you might say you've got something that you could see that good examples cutting on by the Great Bear Forest or Haida Gwaii, and certainly the Revelstoke Castlegar management. You know, there are various aspects of the problem have been dealt with productively and imaginatively in small parts of the province. In all those cases where it's really worked, it's had support from on high. People said, give them the freedom to make this work. But really, the muscle, the mind, the spirit has come from the communities themselves. Enough.
This is CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You've just heard a remarkable speech on community building in difficult times by Dr. John Halliwell, a fellow of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research at www.cifar.ca. That's CIFAR.ca. We've learned that people need far more than jobs to make a resilient community. Now we'll get a response from Dana Hayden, Deputy Minister of Forests and Range for the Province of British Columbia.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Halliwell. That was a wonderful sampling of both your research findings and application to not only international situations, but British Columbia situations. I was intrigued before the talk when you were asking me about my experience in the round table in going around and talking with different forest communities, which I had the opportunity to do last year, and what my observations were on communities. And before I'd sort of seen your results, I think what I observed was probably entirely consistent with where your research is going, because I was sort of saying that notwithstanding the fact that most of the communities that we were going to were facing extreme difficulties with mill closures, with, you know, lack of employment, all of the economic issues, I guess, that go along with problems in the forest sector, that there were really communities who were thinking positively about the future and trying to find solutions. And in every single one of those situations, I think I can point to a reality where people would come together in those meetings and would think together about how to find solutions and how to be positive and present ideas that really were there for them to grab onto if only they had some support. And I can also point to other communities that we went to where a similar economic situation may be going on, but frankly, the members of the communities were much more interested in arguing with each other over, you know, a limited fiber base or who was getting what piece of the pie, and really weren't very interested in thinking forward about how they could solve their own solutions, but probably were much more focused on trying to figure out how to carve out their own piece of the pie. And so I think that probably is, in my own small example, supporting the research that you've done. And I always thought we lived in the best place on earth, so I'm not sure why we're not happy here, but but hopefully you've brightened our day a little bit. So we have an opportunity now to, I guess, think a little bit about what Dr. Halliwell's telling us and our own sort of direction, I guess, to well-being. And I think it must be actually a really great thing to spend your time studying well-being. You seem like a very happy person, so you must have you must have figured out the answers to the challenges in front of us. What are some of the learnings that we've heard from you, I guess? Money isn't everything. I guess that's something that we hear a lot, and obviously your research is showing us that. Really the cooperative intent of communities, the abilities of communities to have trust, to work together, really results in sustainable communities, and I think we can see examples of that around the world. And I lived in Newfoundland for a couple of years, and I can tell you, they're very happy there. I'm not sure why. I shouldn't say that. It was a good place to be from, as they would say. I guess the other message that we get out of your short presentation is cooperation. So there's lots of opportunities for us all to cooperate in trying to solve the issues of the forest sector and forest communities. And I know that we can all do better if we can approach our problems with that perspective. So we have an opportunity now with a couple of our esteemed panel members, Doug Konkin and Don Roberts, to have them come up and say a few words about their observations about Dr. Helliwell's talk. And then we will have an opportunity after that to have questions from the audience. And you can ask questions of either our two panel members or Dr. Helliwell. And I'm sure after that stimulating talk, there'll be lots of questions on the secret of life. So, Don, can I ask you to come up first?
I'll give a few thoughts on sort of how I sort of put it into context, because this movements towards community is something that's occurring at the global level, and it's interesting. There's a lot of things going on in this sector right now, and in fact, the changes that we're seeing in this sector, both in terms of structural changes in global markets, forest policies, technologies, they're really as fundamental as we've seen since the end of the colonial era. Dramatic. And one of those changes, in fact, is a clear secular trend towards decentralization. We're seeing it more in the developing world than in the developed, but it's really quite compelling. We're seeing almost a quadrupling of the land under management over the last 10 years that's under management within communities than under central agencies. We're seeing pressure for this right around the world, but it's curious. You know, I thought back to why this was occurring, and you put it on some of the data that said or indicated that trust was greater in Atlantic Canada than in BC. Interesting. One hypothesis to take from that is that is there greater demand for decentralization in those areas where there is less trust? Would we see more in BC than in Atlantic Canada? Well, I don't know. We haven't done that test. But what's interesting, when we go back and look at that data, where there has been the biggest move for decentralization, it's in a group of countries that may have something in common. Russia, China, India, Bolivia, areas where perhaps there's less social trust. At least that was indicated by your data, I think. So is BC the next to go towards decentralization? Why is it? It's because do they less trust? I don't know. But the data is clear. I think that decentralization is an issue where communities are going to play a bigger role. And I say this from the corporate world. That usually just shakes the boots of guys in headquarters. Another observation. I had the privilege last year of leading a task force for Premier Graham in New Brunswick, which is to look at the sector there. And there's a couple of tough questions we were asked to look at. One, was there a future for the forest sector in New Brunswick? Was it a sunset or sunrise? And two, what segments had the most opportunity? So we went out and did a year-long study. I was sort of filled with self-importance and, you know, did work and came up with some results. But the really interesting thing that came out of it for me was what we had to do at the end of it, after submitting the report to Cabinet, is I had to go out and do a series of town hall meetings. I was an investment analyst. That's not usually what I do. I usually deal with 30-year-old hedge fund managers who don't lack for self-esteem. And the interesting thing here is what I guess I took away from the information, what came from the audience. The first thing is that they just wanted the truth. There had been enough dream merchants out there for so long, and they had been sold so many stories that they were sick of it. So you go into Miramichi, and you say, okay, your paper mill's down. And I had to get up in front of a school auditorium of 200 people and say, and it shouldn't come back up. And they didn't mind. They wanted the truth. They also wanted what were the options that we could do. And that really struck me, is that the maturity of the Canadian fabric. In fact, if there's one thing that came away from me, and I've had a chance to work overseas a fair bit, was the civility of dealing with this situation. Recognize you're blessed with that. You know, you go into some areas and you run from the room after you're saying that. We can get that. The second thing was, this underscored what you were saying, the absolute need for transparency here. That is a critical component for building the trust. And we always fight for that. You know, I'm in the information business where guarding information is what we do. But it's the sharing of it which really can give you some power in some cases. And it's just imperative in this sector where we're dealing with the private use of a public resource. You got to get used to it. So anyways, delightful presentation. I'm going to turn it over to Doug.
You've just heard Don Roberts from CIBC World Markets in response to the forestry lecture in sustainability given by Dr. John Helliwell. Next, Doug Konkin, BC's Deputy Minister of the Environment.
Well, I'm just happy, John. I didn't see your presentation a while ago because I would have been very unhappy thinking I was going to follow you. It's funny. I'll just sit down like Don did. You know, I am from government, and once every 4 years we're in the happiness business in government. at this point in time, I come from probably the community that is the least happy, Victoria, right now, in terms of the environment where I'm working. So I'm not going to really try and address all that you've got. Like, Dawn, maybe I'll just make some observations here. First one is that I'm going to try and work with Cabinet on that clapping thing. I think that will really be good. Now, my second thing would be that in my career, I have had, unfortunately, the opportunity to work with many communities that have suffered a pretty significant loss in terms of an economic downturn or a natural disaster of some kind. And it's interesting listening to you and kind of thinking of the way that we have traditionally approached that. And the first thing that struck me is kind of our definition when we're assigned as bureaucrats to kind of go in and address something. We almost start at the opposite end of the spectrum from where you speak. We start from kind of, what's the economic framework? What do we do to create jobs? What do we do to create wealth and income? And it's much less around kind of the social side and the happiness side, but let's get right to what people assume that happiness is all about, and it's jobs in the economy. But although over time we have, I think, started to adjust around that a bit, I certainly know, although I couldn't really have defined it, and I was delighted to see kind of all the definitions there and the ways of measuring it, when you do go into various communities, you do really just automatically get a sense of the community and whether there is, I guess what I'll call personal and community accountability in there, whether they are actually prepared to kind of deal with themselves and start to take leadership, or are they really looking for you to bring all the answers there? And I've never been able to define it, and yet you can feel it just intuitively as you walk into the community, the difference. And it immediately gives you a sense of, frankly, wanting to work there or not wanting to work there in terms of what you're facing. It reinforced for me that kind of through my life, I've always thought no matter what you think the challenge or the opportunity is, it's really about people and how people handle things. I'll make a couple more observations that, one, the province, I think, has gradually started to learn this, and we put out a best practices document not too long ago that really spoke to our observations that it is around social networks that are important, and you have to start to kind of identify the leadership, try and build collaboration, kind of a team approach, learning, visioning, and that's the very first thing now when you look at our best practices document that you try and do. So I think, at least indirectly, we're starting to get at some of this. But I do think we still have some hurdles, and I'll make a couple observations. Is one, we still work within a system where there's a lot of tension between community and provincial levels of ownership and decision-making. And certainly in Victoria, there still is a strong belief that the resources of the province belong to the province and are used for the social, economic well-being of the province in general. And certainly when you go to communities, there's a much different take on that. And again, there's been progress in the province in creating community forests and different things, but there still is kind of a framework there that maybe inherently creates some tension when you're trying to go into a community and work with a community on that. The second thing is, personally, I think some of the community's expectations far exceed the carrying capacity of the local environment. And I know I deal with communities that are in really, really rural, remote environments. And when I deal with the young people in those communities, they are still on the internet, watching TV, and they expect to have the exact same kind of resources, abilities, decision-making, fun, all those things that they see in Vancouver or other big cities. And my observation would be that's a really difficult task, not impossible, but a difficult task to live up to some of those expectations. So I'm not going to go on for a long time. I think the value of it is the interaction. The last thing I will just summarize with is the question I was asked is, can forest communities be stronger after they suffer some strong loss? And my observation is, absolutely. It really depends on kind of the strength of the community to start with, the networking, the social ability, how fast they get there, and where they end up. But pretty much every community that I've seen, even if it just amounts to the people who are unhappy leave and the people who are there just don't give up until they just don't say no until it's over, and it's not over until they've recreated some place where they're satisfied. You may get a smaller community, but you can still end up with a very successful, happy place to live. So there we go.
Now we'll get a response from Dana Hayden.
Facebook or Twitter or things like that that are creating community in a different sense affects sort of the realities that you're seeing through your research. Do you think that has any impact on it? Do you think that that's a different way that people are able to create community? Or do you think that that trust and that someone to count on kind of measure is important to have a close physical proximity?
You can imagine the world changing as fast as it is. There are people running around all over the world trying to answer precisely that question. And I think you'd have to say the jury is still out. It's easy enough to say there are positive aspects and negative aspects and to list some of them, right? Because in a sense, these are very broad networks that can invite you into a seemingly close and human contact and exploit your inherent desire to trust and engage for nefarious purposes. So we've seen all kinds of examples of that. So you could find a broader trust, in fact, being destroyed by the misuse, just like the trustworthiness you assume of the person who calls you on the phone at 6 o'clock at night has dropped dramatically in the last 20 years, right? So common spaces and resources can be misused by people, and they break down the social fabric. And you could imagine how lectures now are starting to... Their social fabric of the human connection in university lectures has been worsened by people doing their Facebooks in the middle of a lecture. Right? You see, the capacity to do that and to gauge with somebody out, or people will bring out their BlackBerries in a social environment. Well, you could imagine how time with family or friends is not going to quite have the same sheen on it. If you look around the group, everybody's out there, their little BlackBerry at work. They're not engaging with each other. So there are risks of these technologies that in fact are connecting and allow you to build and maintain broader networks. In fact, being used in ways that in fact show that the users don't understand the importance of the real human connections and are giving up too many of them in order to achieve a hit from a connection or something that's a bigger one. That said, it is certainly true that the ability to sustain deep human and professional networks at long distance is vastly greater now than it was 20 years ago for the same technologies. So like a lot of technologies, it's how you use it that'll make the difference.
That is all the time we have for this week on the Tuesday Brown Bagger program. You've been listening to the 2009 Forestry Lecture in Sustainability presented by the University of British Columbia Faculty of Forestry. That was September 17th, 2009. I'm Alex Smith for CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver.